You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
Good morning, LawPod listeners. In this episode, we're looking at the way that law, or litigation I should say, can play a role in mitigating the effects of climate change. The European Court of Human Rights has just handed down three judgments, one of which is likely to prove exceedingly contentious and is a major feature in the news coverage today, the day after the judgments appeared on the Strasbourg website. We'll come to that in a minute, but let's first have a look at a ruling from the New Zealand Supreme Court, which I recently posted on in the UK Human Rights blog. This was a challenge to a number of carbon-emitting businesses based on the tort of public nuisance. And then there was a new tort. This involved a duty to cease materially contributing to climate change. The defendant businesses, unsurprisingly, applied to have the plaintiff's claims struck out, as they disclosed no form of action recognisable in New Zealand civil law. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which decided that the plaintiff should have his day in court, and they declined to allow the strikeout. I have with me environmental law specialist David Hart, KC, of One Crown Office Row. David, starting with the New Zealand case, could you set out some detail of who the parties were and what the plaintiff was seeking from the court?
Well, the plaintiff was a Maori major player who owned some land by the edge of the sea, and he was claiming a breach of various duties, which Rosalind has touched on. And he was claiming them from some major New Zealand emitters of carbon, so private entities. And the main plank of his argument was that it amounted to a public nuisance. And as Rosalind again has said, there was this novel attempt to add a tort of materially affecting climate change.
So looking at his claims in tort, negligence, public nuisance, and this new tort, do you think the common law is equipped to deal with such an existential crisis as climate change?
Well, I think it is. I think it has to stretch itself a bit from the way in which it has been deciding cases to date. And this is well illustrated by the claim in public nuisance, because traditionally public nuisance involves showing that the claimant has suffered direct damage to himself or herself over and above the damage which affects the whole of the rest of the town or country or world. And so one could immediately see the novelty in deciding that public nuisance applies. And what the court in effect said was that the direct nature, as required by the case law, needed modifying in the light of the particularities of the climate change problem.
And there was another basis on which the defendants were seeking to strike out the claim, which has to do with the statutory scheme that effectively excludes such a private claim, wasn't there?
That's right, and that's a commonly taken point in the UK. It's really said that Parliament has come up with a statutory scheme, and usually it's said that impliedly claims in tort are excluded. And so the exercise for the court is to decide, looking at the statutory scheme as a whole, is a claim in tort impliedly excluded? And the leading environmental case on this is a case called Marchich, decided about 20 years ago, when a claimant had his claim dismissed for damage caused by sewage flooding. And the defendant successfully argued that there was a scheme under which Ofwat, who is the economic regulator of the water industry, had powers to enforce in respect of breaches of the statutory duties by the sewage undertakers. And so the defendant said, well, that's it, Mr. Marchich, you can't bring a claim in nuisance. And that went to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords said that the defendant's argument was right. That's subject to challenge at the moment in the Supreme Court, who have been considering a case under which Marchich may be restated for the last year or so and hasn't made up its mind yet.
We'll come back to the whole concept of statutory systems excluding private rights. But now let's turn to the recent Strasbourg cases. Each of these three cases was examined by the same composition of the Grand Chamber and raised unprecedented issues before the court, because, of course, the court has not really used the convention to address climate change before. Two of these cases were rejected as inadmissible for interesting reasons which we'll come to, but let's start with the successful one. Verein Seniorinnen versus Switzerland. Here, some individuals and a representative organisation argued that the impact of global warming on their health breached a number of their rights under the Human Rights Convention. David, can you expand on this and how the application was received by the court?
Yes, the court took, in my view, a somewhat surprising approach to it. It said that the elderly women who were complaining about increased numbers of heat waves had no standing to bring a claim before the Strasbourg court. That was because even though they had complaints, they could not necessarily link their complaints of heat waves, etc., to the particular climate issues for which Switzerland might be responsible. But those women were also members of an NGO, an association, whose interests were precisely the same in terms of climate change. And the court, and I think one can only put it this way, fashioned a remedy for the NGO, which it had denied to the individuals who were part of the NGO. It therefore decided in principle that the NGO could bring a claim.
It does seem strange. Why do you think this application was deemed admissible, but the other two climate change applications were rejected?
Well, I think that's a big question, partly because the Swiss case was heard ahead of the Portuguese case. And in the Swiss case, all the big issues which had to be resolved in general terms, in terms of encouraging climate change litigation, were principally decided in favour of the applicants. The Portuguese case, to which we'll come in due course, was heard 6 months later. It involved some teenagers and people in their early 20s complaining again about heat waves, but in terms where they had not gone to court in Portugal, and they'd also sued 30-something other nations for contributing to the climate change problem.
Okay, so basically in the Portuguese case, the applicants had not properly exhausted local remedies. The local remedies were rather impressive there, whereas they weren't in Switzerland. And just going back to the Swiss case, can I, acting as devil's advocate or speaking on behalf of the defendants, say that, well, global warming has not reached the necessary level to create a tangible effect on the private and family life of the individual, and indeed the association under Article 8, including their mental health well-being. How do you think that the court got around that? Or do you think that they shouldn't have tried to?
Well, I can see why they sought to address it in the way that they did. And they were quite explicit in saying that they had to remodel the environmental case law, which had come before the Strasbourg court before, in a novel way. And they said that was necessary because of the differences which were involved in bringing any litigation about climate change. Now, it's arguable that they shouldn't have gone that far, but one can perhaps understand why they did in the light of some I think one can say, slightly fragmentary previous litigation involving the Strasbourg courts, which were, in none of those cases, had the court got together and decided how are we going to address A, environmental claims generally, and B, climate change as a subset of that.
I can see that. But once again, going back to the respondent government's argument, they argued that greenhouse gas emissions generated abroad couldn't necessarily attract the responsibility of Switzerland, as these emissions could not be directly linked to any emissions on the part of the state, whose authorities didn't have direct control over the sources of these emissions. And I'm talking about emissions that come from products coming from abroad, in this case rather elegantly referred to as embedded emissions. How did the court tackle that argument?
Well, let's be sure we know what we mean by embedded emissions. A Swiss citizen buys a car from Germany. The carbon expended in making the car is emitted in Germany, but the car comes to Switzerland. Why did the car go to Switzerland? Because a Swiss person wanted to buy it. So the Swiss person was effectively responsible, directly or indirectly, for the German emissions, even though the car was made in Germany.
So that's a pretty convincing argument, because, of course, we're all talking about this matter being about transborder emissions, going to the merits of the substantive articles of the Convention. It's quite a step to apply Article 8 to the generality of emitting carbon. And nonetheless, the court held by 16 votes to 1 that the applicant association could qualify as a victim under the Convention, and that its complaint should be examined under Article 8. There was a pretty strong dissent from this majority view, wasn't there?
There was. The UK-appointed judge to the Strasbourg court, Judge Eicher, he dissented very strongly, and he made some of the points which I've just been flagging up in advance, really. The fact that this was a very novel way of going about looking at Article 8 litigation in terms of climate change. And also, there was novelty in the way in which the court had dismissed the individual applicant's claims on the one hand, but allowed a claim to be brought by a NGO on the other hand.
He says this case goes to the very heart of the role of the court in these unprecedented challenges posed to humanity by climate change. And he also said, I quote him, that the majority goes beyond the permissible limits of evolutive interpretation, that is the evolving living instrument argument concerning the Convention. And they've created a brand new right. Under Article 8 and possibly Article 2, the right to life, effective protection by the state authorities from the serious adverse effects on their life, health and safety, well-being and quality of life arising from the harmful effects and risks caused by climate change. He doesn't seem to be convinced that the court has the capacity to engage in reviewing the European government's adequacy in implementing climate change measures. Do you feel that this dissenting judgment, though he's only one out of 17, is going to be of some significance in the future? Judge Eicher has, I might say, been widely quoted in today's papers, all of which have been covering this astonishing new step by the Strasbourg court.
Well, I think it might be, but on the other hand, when you've got 16 judges from all around the Council of Europe coming out with an extremely thoughtful critique of the hitherto environmental case law before its court, and saying we have a problem in the form of climate change for which new remedies or modified remedies need to be fashioned.
He does say further in his judgment that in finding a substantive case under Article 8, the court, or rather the majority, shows that it's trying to run before it can walk. What does he mean by that?
I think he meant really that it had got itself into a bit of a muddle about the question of standing for individuals and the NGO. And once it had got into that muddle of, as he would think it, of deciding that the NGO had locus standi. It had then to fashion a right which could be sensibly complained about by that NGO rather than an individual victim.
Okay, so the court having taken this dramatic step in the Swiss case, as you pointed out earlier, David, they considered the case of Agostinho versus Portugal and 32 other states sometime later and pretty much dismissed it on all grounds. Do you think it mattered that they'd made up their minds on the Swiss application before?
I think so, because it meant that when they were deciding to deliver the judgments in all three cases, they knew that they would have their judgment in the Swiss case. And just to give you an idea of that, the judgment in the Swiss case runs to some 260 pages. It covers the whole of international environmental law concerning climate change. It covers political developments more recently, and it looks at the case law of many of the Council of Europe countries. So the Strasbourg court had done its homework and had set out its stall for saying that climate change or litigation ought to be capable of being brought before the court. When it gets to the Portugal case, it doesn't have to do that all again, and it therefore takes a fairly conventional approach to the questions which arose in the Portugal case. This was another heat case. As I said before, it was a case involving people in their late teens and early 20s complaining about heat waves, wildfire, and smoke affecting their various Strasbourg rights. It had two novelties, really. The first was that it was brought against 30-something states. So it was suing everybody in sight who was part of the Council of Europe for their contributions to climate change. It hoped to get round the problem of causation, i.e. proving that a given country was responsible for a material part of the emissions. But it immediately ran up against the problem which obtains in all Strasbourg cases, where you try and sue for an extraterritorial effect. It's an element of the embedded carbon emission point that I was making earlier. And the court said, well, you simply cannot do that. You, the Portuguese young people, live in Portugal. You've got a potential claim against Portugal. But you can't sue the UK for that. The only cases before Strasbourg where the court has found some degree of extraterritorial effect are very extreme cases, and they usually involve state actors in the particular country being sued going off and doing damage in other countries. So you can relate it to the first country, but what you can't do is just say, we, the Portuguese young people, are complaining about the UK emissions because those UK emissions are not something for which Portugal is responsible, and that is the primary ground upon which you can take a case to Strasbourg. So that's the first element, which was novel and which was fairly roundly dismissed by the Strasbourg court. The second element, equally novel, was that the Portuguese applicants went straight to Strasbourg. So they didn't go to the Portuguese courts, get the answers from the Portuguese courts, and then if those answers were against their case, take the case to Strasbourg. And Strasbourg said, well, you can't do that. It's very important to know what the domestic courts thought about it. And there were particularly good reasons in this case, because under Portuguese law, the young people seemed to have quite a strong case for saying that it was in breach of a Portuguese right to a clean environment, etc. And that could have founded a perfectly good claim in the Portuguese courts. which did not need to reach Strasbourg.
Yes, if you read the details of the judgment and compare it to the others, Portugal seems to have quite a generous suite of laws on which you can take action for environmental damage. And in fact, if they had gone to the Portuguese courts, we can see from the French judgment that possibly the applicants would have got their local remedies there. They may not have won before the Strasbourg court anyway, because they'd got what they wanted from the local courts. That's what the third judgment we're about to come on to discuss against France concludes, isn't it?
That's right. This was a case involving a private citizen who had been mayor of a town in northern France, just on the edge of the English Channel. It was low-lying and potentially affected by flooding. And he brought a case in the domestic courts in France, and he brought it together with the municipality of which it was a part. It went to the French courts, the Conseil d'État, and brought judicial review, in effect, for the French institutions not deciding the matter at all. The Conseil d'État said that he didn't have an interest which was capable of giving rise to a claim before the Conseil d'État, but added that the town did. That was the initial decision, and at about that stage, he begins his claim in Strasbourg. Later, when the matter is before the Conseil d'État on the substantive hearing, the Conseil d'État basically gives the town pretty much all of the remedies which had been sought. So it told the French government to go back to do better in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions, and indeed ordered the government to pay something in the order of 20 million euros to environmental organisations. So that's the context in which the claim comes before the Strasbourg court. The Strasbourg court, not surprisingly, says, well, you've basically got what you wanted. It's not a claim about individual claims for damages. It's a claim about sorting out the French state's approach to climate change. And so they were pretty unsympathetic to the claim as a whole. His individual claim, i.e. the one which was before Strasbourg, failed for the fairly simple reason that he had moved from the low-lying French town to become a member of European Parliament in Brussels. So he wasn't even living in the place about which the claim had been brought. And there was no potential claim because he had been former mayor, because the Strasbourg court said, and this is conventional case law, that a municipality cannot be an applicant before the Strasbourg court, because the municipality is in effect one of the institutions against which a Strasbourg claim can be brought. Can't sue itself.
Thank you, David, for that very clear summing up of the case. In all three cases, at least the applicants, whether they were successful or not on admissibility, they got a hearing and hundreds of paragraphs of the court's deliberations as it created for itself its ability to rule on signatory states' climate change measures. In conclusion to all of this, would you agree with the applicants, particularly those in the Swiss case, that it is internationally recognised that, in quotes, averting climate change is an inherent part of the obligation on states to protect human rights?
Well, I think we've got that far because the way in which all of our laws, domestic and international, and the way in which policy has been moving, again, pretty much in a consensus, in favour of the recognition of the climate change problem and the need for states, all states, to do something about it. So it's not surprising that the court should, when given the opportunity of hearing these collective cases, say, well, now's the time to rethink our case law and make a remedy which 5 or 10 years ago we probably wouldn't have done.
Well, that's where we leave it for today. But it's worth bearing in mind that there are 7 other environmental cases, that is climate change cases, awaiting hearing in Strasbourg. So we certainly haven't heard the end of it yet. We may well get you back on LawPod UK, David, to cover these when they come up. Thank you very much for coming on LawPod today.
Thank you.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.